Hello, and welcome to The Sound of Economics. I'm your host, Rebecca Christie. I am a senior fellow here at Bruegel and also the Europe columnist for Reuters Breaking Views. And I am delighted to be here with Duygu Gunner, an affiliate fellow at Bruegel, and Francesca Rosso, who is a human capital development expert at the European Training Foundation. And we are going to be talking to you about skills anticipation. How do we get a workforce that has the skills that are going to be needed in the future? And how do we make this work for everybody? As we get started with today's conversation, Francesca, can you tell us what work goes into anticipating what to anticipate? How do we frame this question? It's such a big question.
Thank you very much, and thanks a lot for having me today. It's a real pleasure to have this conversation. Let me start by saying that skills are really central in the current debate in the European Union and also beyond the European Union. The European Training Foundation works with countries which are neighbors to the EU. So we have this external dimension in mind. But of course, we always refer to the context of the EU. And as you know, the 2023 has been defined as the year of skills, which is running until May 2024. So that tells you the centrality of the discussion about skills. One important point I want to mention before I answer to your very important question is the fact that Europe is recovering after COVID. Employment rate in the EU is extremely high. We got almost 75% employment, is higher than ever. But skills shortages are slowing down recovery. And it is really a central topic of discussion. There are structural drivers of labor shortages, for instance, age, migration, the twin transitions. But what we know, and it's extremely important, is that in the European Union, between now and 2050, we expect to lose every year about 1 million people from the labor market. And this in light of the fact that companies keep telling us that they don't find the people they need for their own work because there are skill shortages, because people have skills which are not in line with what they need. And of course, this is also exacerbated by the fact that there are huge change in the labor market. First of all, the digital transition, but also the green transition. And I mean, all research tells us that these twin transitions are creating even bigger imbalances between the skills that people have and the skills that companies need in the market. So I say skills are central. But what are these new emerging skills? And here I link to what you just asked me. Is it possible really to anticipate? We read everywhere in the media that most of the jobs that will exist in 5 years or 10 years don't exist now. So many people come and tell us it's impossible to know. How do we know? What do we tell education and training? Well, I think we have some elements. We have indication of what will be needed, at least partially. In the ETF, we carry out a series of research, and what we have seen is that the skills that will be needed in the future will be more and more complex. And also we see that, especially this year, because we've been talking a lot about artificial intelligence in the last 12, 18 months, what we see is there is always a growing focus on the potential of individuals, this idea of people being in the middle, this human-centric development or this human-centric approach to artificial intelligence. What we see is that people will have to adapt their skills constantly. And here, for instance, learning to learn becomes one of the key elements that people need to possess. So when you ask me if I have to rank what is the top skills that I would tell people need to have is definitely the ability to learn throughout the course of their life. This is something completely new. And I think this is really the real revolution that COVID has brought to us, making people understand, at least more than before, that they have to adapt, they have to learn new things basically every day.
This is fascinating, and I'm really interested in all of it. But Doiko, I just want to ask you, through all of your work with our Future of Work program, is learning how to learn a skill that can be taught?
Actually, yes. The good news is that learning how to learn is a skill that you can actually acquire over your life course. So it is not something that you have internally from birth, but this is something your social environment, your work, your relationships can teach you over the course of your lifetime. So since I'm not coming from a pedagogical background, I don't really know exactly how we are developing those skills in people. But I know in education, especially for younger generations, so I had a mission with public employment services, and there we were discussing how we can improve the labor market attachment of young people. But and it eventually came to the discussion of when we should be starting doing that, and it rolls out to be even preschool ages. So there is a big group of people from civil societies to formal education institutions to public employment services who are working on generating this learnability skill in people, but maybe it is easier done at an earlier age than later in life. But I think as we learn how the joy of learning, even in a non-job related informal setting, like when I learn a hobby, a skill that has nothing to do with my professional life, once I realize the joy it brings to me, I would have intrinsically an increased motivation to learn, and it would just have spillovers in other areas of my life.
It's such a great setup, because when I talk to my own children and they say, oh, mama, was that smart? I say, well, smart is being able to learn things quickly. It's not what you know, it's what you can learn. So Francesca, how do you put that into practice? You work with teachers and educators, and how do you create this climate of learning to learn?
Well, ETF works with policies. So of course, we also work with teachers, with educators. We have a community of innovative educators. So what we try to also is to give value to the good practices, the experiences that the countries are developing. And there are really good practices in school, teachers that are really bringing forward this idea of learning continuously. And I totally agree with Doiko. It's something that you learn in school, but not only. You learn it in the job place, you learn it into your community. So there is no one single place of learning anymore. If you ask me, where do you acquire as a person the skills that you need on the labor market of today and tomorrow, then I would definitely tell you that there is a huge difference when it comes to the space dimension. It's a different space dimension compared to the one we used to have in the past.
This is great, actually. So what I wanted to ask you next is, what countries do you work with the most, and how do they work with the EU?
Yes, well, ETF works with a group of countries which are called neighboring countries, which go from Morocco in the south of Mediterranean, Morocco to the Middle East, up to Jordan, Israel, Lebanon, then the Western Balkans and Turkey, and then Central Europe. For instance, Georgia, Ukraine, and other countries in the region. And then finally, the five countries in Central Asia. So we have a set of countries which are very diverse, that come from different socio-economic backgrounds. that are at a different stage of development, but that on the other side also have some common features and challenges when it comes to labor market, employment and education. And our mandate is to work with institutions in the country and broadly speaking, other also stakeholders, social partners, and to support the reform process to make education and training more relevant for the labor market and more in line with the needs of individuals. And that's why in the work we do, for instance, we analyze what the labor market now requires, and that's the discussion we started about the new skills demands in the country. And then we use these findings to provide elements or provide policy advice to the institution about how they can reform their education and training policies. That's the work we do. When we do that, of course, we look at the example coming from the EU. ETF is an agency of the European Union. We are the only agency working in the external dimension of the EU. And the European Union, of course, and the member states are full of excellent examples that can be taken as an inspiration in other contexts. Of course, we don't bring practices from one country to another, but we really use it as an inspiration to support reforms which need to be country-owned and country-driven. That's the work we do.
Thanks for that. When we come back, we'll talk more about the role the EU plays in the world. Welcome back to The Sound of Economics. Francesca, you were just telling us about the neighborhood countries that ETF works in. Does it make a difference if these countries are on an accession track to join the EU or not? And how do these workforces interact with the EU workforce?
Well, you touch a very important and politically sensitive point these days that the Council is currently discussing about Ukraine and releasing of funds and so on. Enlargement has been, if you allow me to say, a bit on the side in the political discourse for several years. But after, especially, the aggression of Russia to Ukraine, the geopolitical situation has changed dramatically. And as we all very well know, is now back to the table. And it is back to be really one of the most relevant files for the European Union. So being an accession country, of course, changes a lot the relationship between the EU and the country. Because of many different reasons, because there is a perspective for the country, first of all, and then because there is, in a way, a trajectory which is well defined. The chapters of negotiation, they have been there for several rounds of accession before this one. But what countries know is that there is a realistic, pragmatic vision for them to access to enter into the European Union. The European Union that we will have in 2030 will be probably very different from the one we see today. And for us, when we work with countries, we see a big difference because when countries enter into the negotiation phase, they have to adopt the acquis communautaire in the different chapters when it comes to chapter 19 and chapter 26, which are the two where ETF is highly involved, labor market, employment, and education. Of course, there are a set of rules, regulation, practices that countries have to adopt or adapt to. So this is really a sort of light in a way, or like a sense of direction for countries to embark in structural reforms. When we talk about skills and when we see that there is a complete revolution on the type of skills that people need to have, I refer, for instance, to the digital skills, what we see is that there is a need to completely restructure education and training. It doesn't mean only restructuring, for instance, the curricula. Of course, that's the basis. That's, one of the most important things. But it's also the way in which pupils learn, the way in which teachers get their own training, the way in which they pass their knowledge to the pupils, to the students. So it's the whole system that needs to be reformed. This is something that takes long time. Structural reform are normally really taking long time, but at the same time, countries need also to deliver quick wins. So it's a complex discussion, but I think that this new enlargement perspective can really, in a way, also offer an opportunity for both sides to really embark into this constructive dialogue.
This really complements a prior podcast that we had with Zsolt Darvas and Heather Gravy talking about Ukraine and the benefits of bringing that workforce closer to the EU. Dwigu, I saw a thought go by. What would you like to add to this discussion?
Actually, when I listening to Francesca, it immediately brought to my mind the current discussions around skilled migration and many EU countries lowering the requirements for skilled workers to migrate within in EU. And also now the third-party agreements surrounding around the skills acquisition from outside EU. So like talent partnerships, which is mostly referring to non-EU countries, but mostly North African countries that Francesca is also working on. And it has implications for the in-house skills development of EU. So recent research shows that skill shortages is not like immediately on the agenda. There are other risks that are perceived a higher importance for the next year. But in the long run, the lack of appropriate skills in the labor market, it will hinder productivity, competitiveness a lot in the EU. So migration sort of interventions are going to help the problem in the short run. But in the long run, as Francesca was referring to, we will need to find ways to restructure our education and training systems. And that's not going to be an easy task. So these were the ideas that were crossing my mind when listening to her, like how we are going to have this transform this rigid institution, which is a very national dimension from an EU policymaking perspective.
This is great. I wanted to ask you, how do we fund this and what kind of money do we need?
Funding-wise, it's a tricky question, but I see that when there are funds available, it helps transform the institutions, even at an EU level. So even small seed fundings can help create a snowball effect in the long run. So whatever we can allocate to this, I think it should be allocated there. I think civil society plays a huge role to create these supportive structures, institutional structures that eventually will have impact on how we design formal education.
Yeah, thanks for that. Francesca, can you give us some more context on the funding? How does it work for you and what do you need? What would you like to see going forward?
Well, when you talk about funding, I suppose you refer to the funding of the countries. So how countries can fund their reforms. I think that funds is not really a big problem. It's not an issue. The big problem is the way in which the funds that countries have at their disposal are spent. So I think it's much more difficult, for instance, to work in partnership between actors. Often we hear that it's very difficult to have the world of work talking to the world of education. That is much more tricky. At the same time, when we talk about technology, for instance, we think that it is difficult for countries which are in a stage of development or transition, as the countries where ETF work, to find funds, money, to really purchase that technology or to develop that technology. This is actually not true. Countries can purchase technology. It's rather easy. Funds somehow are found. So it's not really about money, but the problem is more about how you develop the people that know how to use that technology. So the human side, the partnership side, the knowledge part is much more challenging than the funds issue. I think that the fund part is a non-issue, honestly.
Really interesting. When we come back, we're going to talk about the green transition, which is where a lot of these skills and anticipation of skills are going to be especially important. Welcome back to this episode of The Sound of Economics. Francesca, I understand you have done a lot of work on the green transition and maybe have even gone to the latest climate conference. So tell us, what should we be thinking about? How do we approach this?
Yes, thank you very much for the question. This is a question which is very dear to us at the ETF. We have done a lot of work to document how the world of work is changing and how technologies are impacting skills demand in the different countries and in particular in the different economic sectors. And surprise, surprise, what we have found is that also in our countries, in our partner countries, most of the new technologies are linked to the green transition. So the famous twin transitions that we talk about in the European Union are really interlinked. You cannot talk about green if you don't also talk about digital and vice versa. So what we have found across economic sectors is that greening is impacting most of the occupation at all skills level. Initially, when we started to discuss about greening, a few years ago, we thought that only people with high level of skills would be impacted by the change. But our research showed that this is not actually true, because the impact of the green transition is really at all skills level and across economic sector and across occupations. So, for instance, we have seen that, of course, you have a typical, let's say, green sectors such as energy, where you have a lot of discussion and new job profiles linked to the use of water or renewable energies. But you also have other economic sectors, for instance, manufacturing. I refer to automotive. We did an interesting study in the automotive sector in Turkey, or agriculture, or construction. All these sectors are becoming greener. And becoming greener means that there are new jobs that are emerging, but it also means that there are old jobs which are done in a very different way. I want to make you an example, which I bring often to the table, the profession of agronomist. That's a very old profession. And we found it in Israel and in Morocco, where we work on agri-tech and agri-food. Now, agronomists have been there forever. It's one of the oldest jobs in the sector. But agronomists now work in a very different way. They need to master technologies. They need to use drones. They need to even apply some mathematical models to, anticipate changes or weather conditions and so on. So the bottom line is that there are new jobs, but especially there are new tasks in the old jobs. So we see really that there is an overall change of all occupations. Now, when you refer also to the COP28, where we had the great privilege to represent the European Training Foundation, when we went to the COP and when we started to work for the COP already in the past, what we have reflected is that if the green transition implies a transformation of all the economic activities and all the sectors, as I just mentioned, why skills are mentioned so rarely in the discussion about climate change? And when you go to the COP, you have a lot of different events that are organized. And believe me, just like seldomly, skills are mentioned. But how can you support green transition or green economies or green technologies if you don't have people in the countries that know how to pick the new jobs which are created by this green transition? Everywhere in the world, in Europe, but also in our country, we hear, for instance, that there are no people who know how to install solar panels. That's just one tiny example, but that can be replicated, honestly, for dozens of jobs that don't find people with the right skills. So our message to the COP27 in Sharm el-Sheikh, and then this year at the COP28 in Dubai, was really that it is time to bring skills in the loop. They have not been mentioned enough. They need to be part of the discussion because, as I say before, it's much easier to do investments. It's much easier to put money on infrastructure or technologies. It's much much more difficult to generate people who have those skills, those knowledge, those competences, which are needed to really power to make this green transition a reality.
That's such a strong point about the need to bring skills into the United Nations Climate Change Convention conversations. Dugu, how do you see the European Union leading global policy in these areas?
So I think the role of EU is sort of setting standards. It goes for everything. It goes for job quality. It goes for living standards. EU is like a trendsetter, if I may. So by imposing rules for its trade partners, EU policy has a strength to influence external institutional setting as well. So in that sense, as EU remains to be globally a big economy, it has a lot of power to influence the policy externally as well.
As we conclude this episode of The Sound of Economics, I would love to hear from each of you if there are any success stories you can point to that we might be able to use as models for what we want to try to achieve going forward.
I will first respond so that Rebecca can close it with a positive note, because my intuition is that we are performing a bit poorly on how we deal with this skills problem. Since the issue is emerging rather fast, and for green transition, I consider the change in skills composition, the future skills needed for green transition, more easy to understand and comprehend and maybe forecast. But for technological aspect of it, I think it is rather difficult to foresee how the technology will evolve, even in the next few years, let alone in the long run. So I am a bit pessimistic. And I think that unless we foresee some drastic restructuring in how we perceive developing skills like human capital at a formal education level as well, I don't think we can get out of this bottleneck successfully. Now I will leave the floor to Francesca to give a hopefully positive example for us to be more optimistic about the future.
Okay, I will talk about the green skills, but I think it's really linked more in general to skills anticipation. You know, I spoke before about the COP, and the COP has been highly criticized by many, especially the fact that it was done in a petrol state and that these COP repeat year after year without taking too much action, too much decision. Well, it is true, all that is true. But on the other side, it is also true that there is a growing attention to the issue of climate change. And also in our particular topic, skills finally are being discussed, even if only seldomly, but at least they start to be discussed. And skills are now really high in the political agenda, as I said in the beginning of this conversation, in the EU, but also in all the countries where we work. So I think that giving political attention is the first important step to really develop systems that can equip people with the skills they need in the labor market and for their own career. Now, countries cannot avoid this transition. Countries cannot avoid going toward greener economies if they want to be part also of global value chain, because they have to respond to market demands, to new consumer taste. People want to have things and products done in a different, more conscious way. So even companies have to adapt. And I think that there are really good examples that come from the bottom. For instance, every year ETF launched a Green Skills Award. Last year, the winner was a young girl from Palestine who set up her own startup linked to the solar energy economy. So I think really that there are really good examples from the bottom. And also there are many countries that start developing training courses or modules which are included inside their training courses, which prepare people for these greener jobs. So what I think is that there is a need of different actors being involved. So there is a role for governments. And I think governments are eager to play their their role, but also there is a role for companies, and companies have to play their role because they know this is linked to their own survival, basically. They cannot do without. And then there is a point for individual responsibility. People, individuals, being young people, but also adults, need to understand that they have to equip themselves with this skill set, not only at the beginning of their working life, but during the course of their life. So here, the whole discussion about upskilling and reskilling and the individual responsibility to upskilling and reskilling becomes really, really central. So yes, I want to close with a positive note, saying that there are really massive number of good examples coming up from the different countries. Now the challenge, I think, is to bring this example to a system level, so to upstream, to mainstream these practices, so that they can really benefit everyone. That's really the key challenge for the future that I see, to bring this new understanding not only to an elite in the country, but to all people, to all workers, regardless of their skills level.
Thank you, Francesca Rosso from the European Training Foundation. Thank you also to Duygu Gunnar from Bruegel and our Future of Work program and organizer of this series on skills. Thank you, listeners, for joining us. You can find links to all of our research in these areas and all of our podcasts at bruegel.org. And we hope you'll join us next time. Thanks.